Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 8,000 food items from Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the Orient. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock Central Time. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it is a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the afternoon magazine on WILL AM 580 Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. We open this portion of the program with music from the album Buena Vista Social Club. The record, produced by Ry Cooter and featuring Cuban musicians, was a huge success. And according to our guest today, you can hear Buena Vista Social Club songs playing around the clock in Cuba's tourist bars, expensive restaurants, and five-star hotel lobbies. But journalist Eugene Robinson says these gently sexual and savory sweet tunes are not what Cubans dance to. Cuba, he says, dances to more urgent sounds. Cuba's music and its urgency, that is at the heart of Robinson's book, Last Dance in Havana, The Final Days of Fidel and the Start of the New Cuban Revolution. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Eugene Robinson has worked at the Washington Post since 1980, serving as assistant managing editor since 1999. He has served at the Post as foreign editor, London bureau chief, and South American correspondent. He is the author of Coal to Cream, A Black Man's Journey Beyond Color to an Affirmation of Race. His new book is Last Dance in Havana, The Final Days of Fidel and the Start of the New Cuban Revolution, both books published by the Free Press. Eugene Robinson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. When did you make your first trip to Cuba?
My first trip was in about March of 2000. My first book, Coal to Cream, had come out in August of 99, and I'd enjoyed writing the book and tried to figure out what I wanted to do next, and realized that I'd been to just about all the Spanish-speaking countries in the hemisphere except Cuba. And so I was by then assistant managing editor of the Post in charge of the style section, which covers arts and cultures and in addition to general features. And I had the luxury of being able to assign myself to go to Cuba and write about music a bit more current than the Buena Vista music. And, virtually as soon as I got there, I think by the time the cab got from the airport to the hotel, I had already decided, oh, yeah, this is a place I'd really like to write about.
Yeah, so it was immediately clear to you that you could tell a story about Cuban life and politics by telling people about its music?
That wasn't immediately clear. It was clear that I wanted to, that this was a fascinating moment to me in Cuba's evolution. It just seemed from the start that the whole sense was of Cuba nearing the end of something, approaching the beginning of something else. It might be different, it might be similar, who knows, Castro's getting older. It just felt like a fascinating moment, and the music theme really emerged over the course of I think it was something like 9 visits over the last 4 years, and I realized, of course, you see very very early the kind of centrality or ubiquity, at least, of music in Cuban life. I mean, it's hard to walk down the street without hearing music, but it became clear over time that this really was an interesting kind of window into the place and its people.
Yeah, and the idea of dance. That's a really good metaphor for Cuban politics.
I really is. I mean, Cuba has certainly had to do a dance. In the book, I refer to Fidel Castro as perhaps the most skillful dancer of all, because of the way he has managed to survive and have his system survive after following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, which had handsomely subsidized his revolution for many years. Suddenly that was gone, and the predictions were rife that Castro would be gone within a few years. Well, this was in the early 90s, and as you know, he's still there, just celebrated his 78th birthday.
Yeah, as you refer to him, still the dancer-in-chief.
He is the dancer in chief, and the dance metaphor really is kind of as obvious as the music metaphor once you get there. The book kind of opens with a scene. One of my first nights in Cuba, I went to hear a salsa group called Bamboleo that was playing at a place called the Tropical. That's not to be confused with the Tropicana, because which people kind of know of. The Tropicana is a very fancy kind of tourist place with a long history, but it's very kind of, it costs $50-$75 to get in. No ordinary Cuban could afford to go there. But this place called the Tropical had a history as a more popular kind of working class place. It had begun life as kind of a big beer garden where people could kind of dance their cares away. And so I went to hear a very popular group play there, and was just astounded, thrilled, enchanted by the spectacle not only of music but of movement. They have a whole vocabulary of dance moves down there that would take a linguist some time to decipher. It's just amazing to watch.
Has your dancing improved over the time that you've been in Cuba?
Yes, but compared to what? Yes, it's certainly improved from its in absolute terms. But can I keep up on a Cuban dance floor in Cuba? No way. I can fake it for a few moves, but then they go beyond me.
Yeah. Well, we've mentioned Buena Vista Social Club, and that kind of Cuban music is easy to find here. You have to look harder to find some of the musicians that you write about. Maybe you would describe for us the difference between the music we know from that Rikuter disc and the music that fires up the dance floors of Cuba's nightclubs.
Right. First of all, Havana is, and the other major Cuban cities, but especially Havana, is just a fabulous place to hear live music. Almost any night of the week, you have your choice of hearing some of the major bands. The most popular style of music is a kind of salsa, but one that has evolved on the island of Cuba in some isolation from mainstream, you know, Puerto Rican and Colombian and American salsa and New York salsa, and it's kind of funkier, actually, and the band leaders have told me, you know, that they are very specifically influenced by American funk music of the 1970s, groups like Earth, Wind & Fire and Parliament Funkadelic, and it's there's also a kind of jazzy influence to the music. It's very up-tempo. It's very powerful, almost irresistible in terms of its ability to make you want to move and make you want to dance, and it's just fabulous music. And as you said, it's pretty pretty obscure in this country. It's can be found at the big record stores in big cities or in college towns. And now there are some websites too that where you can order some of the music. But that's kind of the predominant form or the most popular form of music that you hear in Cuba. And also increasingly, there's a lot of hip hop music in Cuba, which has its own kind of twists, but sounds a lot like rap music here, except of course it's in Spanish.
Yeah. Now, how did hip hop come to Cuba? When did it become popular?
Well, that's an interesting story. I was going to call it a neighborhood. I guess I'd better call it a development. About 6 or 7 miles outside of Havana proper. It's called Alamar. And this is a huge kind of housing development that was built. It was one of the kind of great housing projects of the revolution. It was started in the early 1970s, and was to be a great kind of achievement of the revolution. It's hundreds, literally, of these kind of big blocky apartment buildings occupying this vast terrain. At least 100,000 people live there, probably a good deal more. These are kind of Soviet-style apartment blocks. It's in an area that's right kind of on the beach east of Havana. It's not a popular neighborhood to live in. People don't particularly want to live there because it's distant from jobs. You have to take buses to get there. It's inconvenient, and the construction left a lot to be desired. So these buildings are kind of slowly crumbling under the onslaught of the kind of sea breeze and storms and everything. But it has one amenity that most places in Cuba don't have. It gets pretty good there. You can get pretty good TV and radio reception from Miami most of the time because it's right there on the beach. And so in the early 1990s, kids were listening to hip hop radio from Miami and watching Soul Train. And so, of course, as kids do, I mean, they imitated what they were hearing, and also the way of dressing, and as a result, a kind of hip hop culture began to form. It originated in that area called Alamar, but then spread across the island. Hip hop is a very powerful cultural force. That's one lesson that I think you can see in many countries around the globe, and you see it in Cuba. Alamar remains a real kind of center of hip hop culture and music, but now it is kind of one of many as opposed to the only one.
When the kids in Cuba started listening and then imitating, that's what they were doing at first. They were imitating.
Right.
But then that changed.
Right. They started rapping about their lives and their situations. And as a result, they started bringing up themes that were controversial and beyond controversial in Cuba. I mean, they first of all, this is mostly a kind of Afro-Cuban phenomenon, and these kids started rapping about racism in Cuba, which the revolution was supposed to have eliminated and certainly did go a long way toward diminishing, but did not eradicate, and which they felt in many ways was starting to get worse. And they rapped about the police. The police in Cuba are certainly present in the tourist neighborhoods and out in the other neighborhoods as well, often just kind of standing on a street corner. And every once in a while, quite often actually, they just randomly pull citizens, pedestrians, over to ask to look at their identity papers. You're supposed to carry your identification papers at all times in Cuba. Well, here in the States, we talk of, the black folks, we talk about the crime of driving while black and getting pulled over by highway patrolmen. Well, the equivalent in Cuba would be walking while black, and these young black Cubans were saying, especially young black Cuban men were saying, they were the ones who got singled out and pulled over and hassled by the police, while others did not. And then it kind of went a bit beyond that to more general themes of, what's the future for me here? What's these things are happening in the rest of the world. What's going on here? What am I supposed to, what's my life supposed to be like, you know, at this time in Cuba and this system? And this is, as you recall, at a time when the Cuban economy was really in bad shape, and when this started, it still hasn't really recovered. And, you know, these kids were going to school, they were well educated, and they were looking toward going to college, and so they would graduate and then be able to get a job that paid the equivalent of, you know, $10 to $15 a month, and so they started asking these kinds of questions. They were careful not to cross certain kind of bright lines. I mean, you can't get up in front of an audience and say down with Fidel, down with the revolution, and a lot of these kids wouldn't have wanted to do that. Actually, I mean, everything, all they have ever known is Fidel Castro and the system, the revolutionary system that exists in Cuba. But they were saying, you know, you promised us this is the way, this is what the government promises, and this is what it delivers, and it's not the same thing. And this really kind of stung the government at first.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of something that you'll hear in Illinois politics, you know, in terms of again, the dance. You know, you dance with the one who brought you.
Right, you do.
And I think that, you know, that holds here. I mean, on the one hand, Castro can be a problem, and the police are a problem. But on the other hand, what would we do without him?
Well, exactly, and no one in Cuba really knows the answer to that question. What would they do without him? And and add to that too that there are aspects of the Cuban system that are, at least in my observation, fairly broadly popular in Cuba. I mean, the educational system until fairly recently, the health system, which is not quite what it was 5 or 10 years ago, but still delivers an infant mortality rate that's lower than that of the United States. So the kids weren't saying, let's get rid of all this. They were saying, you know, let's do better, and kind of challenging the government to do better. And at first, the government reacted the way you might anticipate. I mean, they you know, what is this? We can't have this. They broke up a few concerts, especially out in Alomar, and kind of sent the kids scattering, although they never really did start, you know, kind of hauling people off to detention or anything, but they just didn't like this going on. But finally, after this had actually been going on for a couple of years, the culture minister, who is known as one of the more progressive voices in the Cuban Politburo, and they still have a Politburo in Cuba, which says something. The culture minister gave a speech in which he said, hip-hop is an authentic expression of Cuban culture. This had to have been approved by Fidel Castro, the speech, because what it meant was, we're not going to try to squash this inconvenient expression from the kids. We're going to try to put our arms around it and bring it into the tent and direct it in ways that we find constructive and keep an eye on it rather than openly confront it.
Yeah. Now, the Minister of Culture, Alberto Prieto, prior to joining the government, he worked for a radio station, and he wanted to do a hip-hop show, and the station's management said, well, that's just black music. Again, here we have that racial thing going, but I wonder if the Cuban government's recognition of hip-hop and its giving state support to hip-hop has changed, has had an impact on race and Cuba.
Well, I think it yes, I think maybe really the converse. I think there is a kind of broader recognition that there are racial issues in Cuba that either were unaddressed by the revolution or that were addressed but that have resurfaced and arguably are getting worse. And I think that helps form the context for why the government, for the way the government has treated hip-hop. I mean, I think they had to honestly listen to some of what the kids were saying and say, well, yeah, you know, they kind of have a point. The reason people, many Afro-Cubans I've talked to, think racism is getting worse in Cuba has gotten worse over the last few years, is tied up with the economy. There are two pillars of the Cuban economy now. One, remittances from overseas relatives, and second, tourism, the tourism industry. And Afro-Cubans feel that they get kind of a lesser share of those two industries, I guess, than they really should. You know, you have to have dollars in Cuba, U.S. dollars, in order to have a decent life. Really, in order to make your food budget stretch to the end of the month, and the remittances from overseas Cubans. Well, the wealthier Cubans who live overseas tend to be white. Those you know, the people who were wealthy at the time of the revolution and left early were white, as a general rule. And so when they're sending their money back to Cuba, those who do are kind of disproportionately sending money to white Cubans. Well, not much you can do about that, but in terms of tourism, black Cubans have told me, and many have told me, that they really feel kind of that they don't get their fair share of jobs in the tourism industry, which has really grown over the past decade, which is so desirable to work in because it puts you in contact with tourists who tip in dollars. So, you know, one of the kind of best or most lucrative jobs you could get in Cuba right now would be as a hotel doorman, for example. Mm-hmm. That would be a really great job to have because, you know, you're opening and holding the door for all these Germans and Canadians and Italians and some Americans who, you know, slip you a dollar tip, and you're really quite an affluent person in Cuba.
Mm. Journalist Eugene Robinson is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Last Dance in Havana, The Final Days of Fidel and the Start of the New Cuban Revolution. Eugene Robinson has worked at The Washington Post since 1980, serving as assistant managing editor since 1999. Last year, March of 2003, while the U.S. invasion of Iraq was getting underway, Castro began a crackdown. What led to that crackdown? Who did the government get tough with? And what did this mean for Cuban rappers?
Well, a couple of things happened as the world was paying attention really to Iraq and the war was about to start. Castro, with kind of no advance warning and no indication that he would do such a thing, arrested and then quickly tried and jailed 75 dissidents, 75 members of the small dissident movement. This isn't the first time in the history of the Cuban Revolution something like that has happened, but it hasn't happened for some time. This sort of, you know, mass, you know, roundup, agents going out all over the city, all over the country, hauling people in, very speedy trials with only one result. There were kind of interesting reactions to it. Very frankly, the reaction on the part of many Cubans to that to those arrests was a big, you know, who. The dissidents really aren't that well known in Cuba, and the move, dis- dissident movements haven't really been that effective, and the trials demonstrated that all the dissident movements were just riddled with Cuban government spies. So Castro knew what they were doing before they knew what they were doing. Why did he do this? Well, I don't think anybody really knows, but it seems fairly clear to me, at least through surmise, that it really comes at the end of a period of worsening relations with the United States, particularly conflict with the Bush administration, and indeed the dissidents were essentially charged with being agents of a foreign power, which is the United States, and some were, you know, independent journalists who had written for a website that is based in Florida and that is funded with some U.S. government money, and in most cases got $15 or $25 per article or something like that. But that was interpreted as being paid by a foreign power to undermine the Cuban Revolution. It's hard for me to imagine that Castro felt threatened by the dissidents. Rather, he seemed to be making a point to the Americans, and so I think that's what that was about. Another thing actually happened around the same time, which was that there was a spate of hijackings. A couple of small planes were hijacked and flown to Florida. Some boats were hijacked to be brought to Florida, on which the hijackers wanted to defect to Florida. And a group of Cubans hijacked one large vessel. I guess boatjacked would be the infelicitous term. And the Cuban military managed to bring them back to port. And Castro immediately had the hijackers arrested, and within 8 days they had been tried, sentenced to death, and three of them had been executed. Now that got the attention of mm-hmm. the general Cuban populace and was shocking to Cubans, because it had been a long, long time, really since the early days after the revolutions, since anything like that had happened. I mean, these capital punishment is really quite rare in Cuba. To have it happen all in the course of a week was just startling to people, and seems to be really part of a more general return to more doctrinaire socialism that Castro is trying to engineer as he approaches the end of his tenure.
Mm. And the Hip Hop Nation, how did they react?
Well, they were rattled like everyone else. They had their own kind of interaction with the government to deal with. You recall the government had decided to embrace or try to embrace the Hip Hop Nation and control it or have some control over it. Well, the government had set up a kind of state enterprise, state business, through which the hip hop business was supposed to channel. These businesses exist for other forms of music. They set one up for hip hop, and that was to give the government the ability to choose which rap groups got recording contracts, which ones were allowed to appear on television, which ones were allowed to, got good opportunities to perform at the major venues in Havana and other cities. And so that's kind of what the Hip Hop Nation was dealing with. They were also dealing with a government that almost whimsically would kind of change the rules. You could, for a while, they could have weekly hip hop shows at a certain club, and then it would just be decided decided without telling anybody, well, no, they couldn't have it there anymore. They could have it at a different club on a different day, and maybe for a while they couldn't have it at all, and then they could have it again. And it was so they were kind of trying to deal with all of that. I would say that in general the government was only partly successful. They are now able to exercise some control at some level, but of course hip hop is viral. It spreads and it pops up in places where it's least expected. You don't need anything but a microphone and something to say to be a rapper. And so what the government hasn't really been able to impact is the little impromptu performances in recreation centers and out in the neighborhoods. That's just kind of beyond their reach. And so as a result, the Cuban hip hop nation, a bit more underground, but still continues to flourish.
Yeah, this dance that hip hoppers, rappers do with the government, does it happen in other sectors of Cuban culture, drama, film, religion?
To a certain extent, certainly to a certain extent in visual art, for mm-hmm. example, there are visual artists who very cleverly kind of push the envelope and manage to express things that would be difficult to say directly in Cuba. Religion is an interesting is another interesting case. The Cuban Revolution, of course, didn't really. It's a communist system. It didn't recognize religion, but didn't really try to squash it in a sort of really brutal way. And so religion always kind of continued throughout the revolution, both Roman Catholicism and the Afro-Cuban, the various Afro-Cuban faiths, which we in this country tend to lump together under the term Santeria. It's not a term you really hear very much in Cuba. They have other terms for the various strains of the faith, but that remained a really constant presence in Cuban life, as it had been before the revolution. And in 1992, Cuba officially lifted all sanctions against religion. So both Catholicism and the Afro-Cuban faith were able to flourish even more openly than they had before. And I particularly find I find that interesting. The one dissident kind of initiative that has that in the past, well, really since the revolution, that has gotten a lot of international notice and really had an impact, although ultimately it was unsuccessful, was something called the Varela Project of a couple of years ago. It was lauded by former President Jimmy Carter when he made his visit to Cuba. It was a petition drive to collect signatures to force the government to allow some freedoms that it said it would guarantee, but really didn't. And it's kind of interesting that the Varela Project really came out of a Catholic Church-based movement. Another interesting thing is that the Afro-Cuban faiths have there's very strict control over the media and over methods of communication in Cuba. You certainly couldn't start your own newspaper. There's a lot of control over things like computers and copy machines and things like that. But the one really, really viable alternative method of disseminating information that I've seen in Cuba, aside from just the grapevine of, oral grapevine, is through the Afro-Cuban faith. Every at the beginning of every year, the babalawos or priests, kind of form a high council and get together and issue their predictions for the year, which comes out in the form of a letter that, the one kind of non-official communication that I've ever seen circulate at just lightning speed, in Cuba is the Babalao's annual letter, which seems to instantly reach all corners of the island and is read and debated and talked about. I kind of see this as one of the elements of a kind of civil society that has formed beneath the radar scope in Cuba, and that potentially could be important someday after Fidel Castro's death. Who knows when that will come, but as I said, he is 78.
Yeah. What kind of topics, what kind of issues do these letters deal with?
They deal with, is it going to be a good year economically? Is it, it's almost like an almanac in a way. I mean, it tell you, the weather's going to be good. There's going to be some storms coming through in September. It's economically it's going to be a good year. It's going to be difficult for this and that. It's kind of a combination almanac and also spiritual advice and instruction from the Babalawos. It deals with it's usually several pages of typewritten pages long, and people kind of pour through it because it's open to interpretation, of course, as to exactly what it means.
Yeah. Now, within the Catholic Church, there are pastoral letters that are handed to churches. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that happens in Cuba. And often those letters from the bishops are quite political in this country and quite pointed. Mm-hmm. Does that happen in Cuba?
Not so much. It has happened a couple of times. There have been a couple of instances when the church has either through that vehicle or just directly spoken out on an issue. But in general, the Catholic Church stays away from politics in Cuba.
Hmm. We haven't really talked in specifics about the content of the lyrics of the music. Mm-hmm. What kinds of things are said? What kind of stories are told in this music?
I'm walking down the street. You pull me over. You say, I'm talking to a policeman. You pull me over. You hassle me. You ride me down to the station and ride me back, and for what? Just because I'm black? That's one story that you hear a lot. Some are kind of interesting. There's one group did a piece in which they kind of talked about it was almost a nostalgia song. Like, talked about the kind of old days when the Russians were around, used to be around, but contrasting it with the present day and talking about the kind of poverty that relative poverty that people are suffering now. There was one song in particular by a group called Clan 537. That kind of popped up a couple of years ago, and it was called, the translated title would be "Who Threw the Chalk?" as in the question that a teacher would ask when a piece of chalk comes up from the back of the classroom. And the song, the lyric went, "Who threw the chalk? It was that black kid. It wasn't the doctor's son. Doctor's son presumed to be white." And then went on to talk about this kind of presumption that the black kid whose father was a laborer and who lived in a very humble circumstances, the presumption that he wouldn't really amount to anything, and the presumption that the doctor's kid, who was a bit more privileged and lived much better, and the family had a car, and that he was fine, and that certainly it couldn't have been him couldn't have been he who threw the chalk.
In the U.S., hip hop rap is very popular among all kids, I would say, or many kids. Is it also universally popular in Cuba among kids?
I'd say not quite, but almost.
Uh-huh.
Most Cuban kids in their in their teens and their 20s are fans of the dominant kind of salsa form of music, and fans of some groups in particular. They might also be, they would certainly be aware of, other sort of international pop music movements. But I'd say that at this point, you could probably say that most are also hip-hop fans, to at least some extent. And if you go to a hip-hop show by a popular Cuban group, it's jam packed, and as I said, it really spreads. It's really an interesting cultural force in not only in Cuba but in lots of other places in the world.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that I went looking for some of this music yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and you can find it, but it's difficult. And where I looked, it was out of stock, but I could reorder it, but not in time for today. And also, I thought it was interesting that the libraries have some of this music, not very much, but it was checked out. As you say, this music, music can be viral. It's powerful.
It is powerful, and it gets around. I mean, there are I do kind of list some of the mm-hmm. groups in an appendix to the book that you might look for. There's also there is a website, one Descarga, descarga.com, where a pretty wide variety of Cuban music is available. There's not much hip hop that's recorded. That one group that did Who Threw the Chalk does have a CD out, and that could be Clan 537. You can get that. And there's one other very popular hip-hop group, but they ended up moving to Paris, Orishas. You can find their music. You can't find a lot of other Cuban hip-hop recorded. I guess I should mention there's also a website connected with the book, too, that I put together called LastDanceInHavana.com, so you can maybe sample a bit
sure.
of the music there as well.
Yeah, very good. We have to wrap up. One of the things that we haven't talked about today, except to maybe touch on somebody like Alberto Prieto, all the wonderful people that are in this book, all the people that you met, from cab drivers to musicians to kids. Maybe to wind up here, you would tell us just a little bit about somebody.
Well, let's see. I'll tell you about Juan de Marcos, who is who was Rye Cooter's Cuban partner in the Buena Vista Social Club phenomenon. He's actually more than that. Juan de Marcos is a band leader in Cuba who actually had assembled all those wonderful old musicians and already had them in the studio by the time Rye Cooter arrived, and then kind of incorporated Rye Cooter's style and sensibility into it, and he's really one of the brightest and most interesting people I've ever met. He has a group called the Afro-Cuban All-Stars. He made millions from his own group and from the Buena Vista Social Club phenomenon. He is he's an extremely wealthy man who who travels widely, tours the world, could live in any country on Earth, and stays in Cuba. He lives in Cuba. He actually lives in that neighborhood I was telling you about earlier, Alomar, although he doesn't live in one of the apartment buildings. He lives in a very nice house. And he's emblematic of so much that is so great about Cuba and the Cubans. He's just so smart and so full of energy and so and enthusiasm, but there's a bite to him. Yeah. And you know, if you ask him and other Cubans, you know, what they want for their country, they want a Cuban pass for their country. They don't want any sort of future that's imposed from the outside. And that's something I kept coming up against again and again.
Yeah, he seems to me to be a very, as you mentioned, very intelligent, quick and delightful kind of guy, and also a very proud Afro-Cuban.
Yes.
Yeah. Eugene Robinson, we're out of time. Thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, Celeste.
Eugene Robinson has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His new book is Last Dance in Havana, The Final Days of Fidel and the Start of the New Cuban Revolution. The book is published by the Free Press, and you can find a website, lastdanceinhavana.com, on the web. And that interview with Eugene Robinson was from August of this year, August 18th, 2004. You've been listening to an interview from the archives. You'll find interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and Focus 580 on our website. Visit will.uiuc.edu. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices have been in now for quite some time from the Chicago Board of Trade. The markets closed today at noon. Here with the numbers, Todd Gleason. Todd?
Thanks much, Celeste. Before we get to those numbers, I know that they've been closed for a long time. Just wanted to update you that, of course, if you've looked outside, you know that the weather is pretty rocky out there at this point. And our own chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser, has agreed to come on a little bit later at about 7 after the hour of 2 o'clock. He's still gathering some information up about what weather is across the two-state region, but lots of warnings and forecasts for high winds and storms winter storms, actually, across much of the two-state region, especially the northern reaches of our listening area. If you're interested, I guarantee that about 7 after the hour of 2 o'clock during the closing market report, Ed Kieser will be here, and he'll give you all the details that he possibly can about the weather forecast for tonight. I know many people will be traveling. Stay with us, and he'll give you an idea of what the weather's going to look like as you're traveling across this vast part of the prairie state of Illinois and, of course, the Hoosier State in there in Indiana. Now let's take a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon. Futures in the bean pit were lower, about 7 cents lower, in fact, 7 to 8 cents. That extended probably some losses on some very, very low volatility. And, of course, the BSE cow that had come out last week was confirmed as a false alarm this week after they did secondary test, which are the primary test, in fact, for that disease. That proved not to be the case last night. BSE, not the case in the cow that was tested last week by USDA. That had pushed the numbers up, actually, in the bean meal on the idea that bone and bean meal might have to go more into the marketplace if another mad cow happened to be picked up in the United States as a replacement for some feedstuffs. Meal, of course, dropped today, and that precipitated the drop in the beans. But we'll talk about that with Paul Cooley a little later in the program. Let's start in the wheat pit now. December contract, 302, the high today. The low at 298.5 in the wheat from the Chicago Board of Trade. Settlement price there at 299.25, and they were off a penny and a quarter. And the March contract, a 312.75 high, low at 308. Settlement price at 310 down 1. The May futures were off a penny and a half with a high of 319.5, a low at 316. Settlement price at 316.75. July futures in the wheat pit, 327, the high, the low at 323. Settled at 324.5, down a penny and a quarter. Dease corn for the day, 198.75, the high, the low at 197.5. Settled 197.75 in the December contract, down a quarter. March unchanged at 208.25 with a high of 209 and a low at 208. May contract at 216.5 high, low at 215.5. Settled 215.75, unchanged. And the July corn down a quarter for the day, 223 and three quarters the high, the low at 222 and three quarters. July settled at 223 even. September futures, 231 and a half high, low 230 and three quarters, settled 231 unchanged. And next year's Dease contract for the new crop corn, 240 and a half the high, the low at 239 and three quarters, settled 240 and a quarter, and they were unchanged. Dease oats at 150 and three quarters on a settlement price up a half, the March contract unchanged at 152. From the soy complex, the nearby January meal, or rather January soybeans, 561 and a quarter high, low at 553 and a half, settlement at 554, down 7 and a quarter. And the March at 564 and a half high, low at 556, settled 556 and a half. They were off 8 cents. May beans, 571 for the day on the high, low at 563, settled 3 quarters of a cent above that at 6 and a half lower for the day. And the July soybeans, a 577 and a half high, low in settlement price, both at 570. They were off 7 and a quarter. The September contract settled at 578, and it was off a half cent with a 578 high, low, and settlement price all for the September contract in the bean pit. Bean meal settled at 161.10 in the December contract, down 150, and December bean oil at 21.11 was off 56. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Okay, Todd. Livestock prices finished higher today. In fact, the cattle were up quite nicely today. January feeder cattle, 102.72 and a half, the high 101.05, the low 102.27 and a half, the settlement at up 255. March, 98.90, the high 97.70, the low 98.55, the settlement at up 210. April, 98.15, the high 97, even the low 97.12 and a half, the settlement that up 177 and a half. December live cattle, 90.15, the high 87.90, the low 89.90, the settlement that up 265. And February live cattle, 90 even the high, 88.35 the low, 89.95 the settlement, that up 210. December lean hog, 76.95 the high, 75.70 the low, 76.55 the settlement, that up 45. February, 75.35 the high, 74.10 the low, 75.27 and a half the settlement, that up 85. April lean hog, 71.77 and a half the high, 70.45 the low, 71.72 and a half the settlement, that up 82 and a half. May, 70.70 the high, 69.70 the low, 70.62 and a half the settlement, that down 2.5 cents. And February bellies, 101.80 the high, $100.40 the low, 101.15 the settlement, that up 40. The Dow is up 4 points, while the NASDAQ is 15 higher, the S&P 500 up 4 points.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
A question about nutrition, Dr. Science, from Bob Pease in Hollywood, California. Dear Dr. Science, if we're not supposed to eat animals, how come they're made out of meat?
You know, until I did the research, I used to think it was just another one of those cruel cosmic jokes. The never-ending